because you have to be able to, you have to be able to bring this present to see how this plagues our time. I'll give you the passages again. The only proposals in the Senate that I've seen fit to mention are the ones that are particularly praiseworthy or scandalous. It seems to me, as a historian's foremost duty, to ensure that merit is recorded and to confront evil deeds and words with the fear of posterity's denunciations. Who said, "History will absolve me"? Fidel Castro. What is the idea? The whole idea here is that there's a big book in the sky where the deeds are written down, and whether it's in the collective unconscious, or whether it's in the world moral community, or whether it's in the historical development, you're going to be castigated. What's the number one fear that Ronald Reagan had? That he will be judged harshly by posterity. It was an obsessive fear that he had. Who else had that obsessive fear? Gorbachev. He is afraid of what posterity will think of him. It's characteristic of all powerful world leaders now. It's a disease. It works for the good and the short range. It is absolutely devastating in terms of actual human achievement. You cannot do the right things for the wrong reasons very long. One more quotation from Tacitus here. I find that this Marcus Lepidus played a wise and noble part in events. He often palliated the brutalities caused by other people's sycophancy, as he mitigated the brutalities that were incurred by people being sycophants to those in power. Marcus Lepidus. He lived at the time of Tiberius Caesar, about 20 AD. And he had a sense of proportion, for he enjoyed unbroken influence and favor with Tiberius. This compels me to doubt whether, like other things, the friendships and enmities of rulers depend on destiny and the luck of a man's birth. Instead, may not our personalities play some part, our characters play some part enabling us to steer away, safe from intrigues and hazards, between perilous insubordination and degrading servility. So, there's a kind of a philosophic conundrum that's hidden here in these excerpts and passages from Tacitus that characterize the Roman mind. Here's how it reads in this commentary. It's a good enough characterization of it. Still, there is more than a philosophic conundrum in the passage. We have also to do with the historian's reflections on Roman conduct and Roman ideals that can also be at odds with each other. He has been dealing with history in terms of traditional Roman values and exploring the causes of a decline from them. Here we can gain some idea of what Roman virtue meant to Tacitus as it was illustrated in the life and conduct of Lepidus, Marcus Lepidus. It is a virtue of a different shape from the first articulated in Roman aristocratic society. A virtue profoundly altered by the development of the Principate in Rome. And what he's talking about here is that when Rome was a republic, virtue was a certain thing linked to the land. When the empire came in, the Principate, the empire, the Roman Empire, virtue was not linked to the land, but was linked to a kind of a pattern put together in the idea of citizenship. One could be a member of the Roman Empire on the basis of citizenship, the idea of citizenship, and not that you were born in some geographical location under Roman, the original Roman family rule. For instance, when challenged, St. Paul, always claimed protection because he was a Roman citizen. "You can't do this to me," he would say, "because I'm a Roman citizen," which gives you an insight into the personality of Paul. Tacitus is talking about a crisis where two kinds of virtue had clashed and one had overtaken the other. The idea of virtue of the empire had taken over, and he is concerned about this. So in this commentary, it is a virtue of a different shape from that first articulated in Roman aristocratic society during the Republic, a virtue profoundly altered by the development of the Principate in Rome. Augustus's Principate was the founding of the empire. Its object, of course, remains the same, the acquisition of vera gloria through significant actions on behalf of society. What glory? What glory for us and for our country. Our panzer divisions will overrun them and they will sing songs about us. It's all of one piece. It's all the same idea, I tell you. The same idea. Gloria Patria Est, the great First World War poem, English poem written about how glorious it is to die for one's country. The acquisition of vera gloria, through significant actions on behalf of society. There is no problem as to what is sought or how it is to be sought. Gloria can only be achieved through good art, bona artes, not good art like we would understand art, but the good activities conditioned by obedience to the right authorities. And if execution depends on force, execution as in doing something, depends on force, that force must be guided and refined by sapientia. Not mystery school wisdom, but sapientia in sizing the situation up right. Who's got the power, what can be done, and under those conditions, what should I do to help things go into their inevitable way? It's what passes in Washington, D.C. these days as political wisdom. It's exactly what passes there, and that's about it. Not only in the politicians, in the political reporters that report the actions also. One can carry this to poignancy that is almost unbearable. Which in itself, the sapientia, in other words, notice what really is operative here, the practice is force. We have the ability to obliterate the enemy. All we need is the will to do it. What is the will? The will of the people to see that this is what we must do. So that the sapientia is like the wisdom of the time, not the ageless wisdom. This is a masculine surrogate parallel to the timeless feminine, Sophia. The masculine surrogate is that, well, this is the wisdom that's going to get us through today. It's Roman. It's particularly Roman. they refined it to the nth degree. At this time, 1st century AD, the problem was how to practice virtue under emperors who might be of an all too jealous eye. In other words, how is anybody going to do anything when the prime virtuous actor is the emperor? Because in this thing, authority in the individual, there's a kind of universal resonance. The only person who really had any authority at all was the emperor. Now, this is a universal pattern. It's characteristic of Chinese history as well as Roman history. The Chinese emperors were the only real actor at all. Han Wuti had a bureaucracy of 140,000 people, all to serve his will and needs. And that's how the Han dynasty was characterized. And all emperors are like that. The only person who can really act, who really, in their own individual, is congruent with the authority in its complete pattern, is the one, Der Führer, or whoever it happens to be in whatever characterization of the society. So the problem for everyone else is, where am I on the pecking order? How much of my individual can I allow to develop given the circumstances that I have to work in? How am I going to adjust to these vicissitudes? Can you see the insidiousness of that? It's insidious, I tell you. The problem was how to practice virtue under emperors who might be of an all too jealous eye, so that the virtue proclaimed in the empire was constricted into virtuous in obsequendo. In other words, only in terms of conforming obediently to the situation. So we have a little bit of Tacitus, starting from Collingwood. Now to Burckhardt in the Renaissance, and the Renaissance revitalized all of those errors. All of that glory came back into effect, and the whole problems were refreshed and given great vigor. And they came back into human history just as if no one had ever woke up from that nightmare. Here's how the chapter in Burckhardt is chapter 6, The Opponents of Tyranny. This chapter was favorite reading of Thomas Jefferson. The founders of the real United States knew all these issues. Franklin and Jefferson and Madison had read their Tacitus, had read their material. They didn't have to depend on Burckhardt putting it together. They understood this material, had seen it themselves. In the face of this centralized authority, writes Burckhardt, in face of this centralized authority, all legal opposition within the borders of the state was futile. The elements needed for the restoration of a republic had been forever destroyed, and the field prepared for violence and despotism. So one of the things the Renaissance gave a rebirth to was a society based on violence and despotism, the despotism of the strong man. They brought it all back, intact. So that the roots of an alternate pattern, one responsive to nature, a republic were destroyed by Renaissance political theory, because they brought it back on the basis of the Romans, who had already destroyed it in their own time. That's why the very careful language in terms of the founding of the United States, this nation and the republic for which it stands. It means that we are all members of the same tribe, and our tribe has made a political form known as a republic, which is expressively amplifying our desires and our needs and our purposes, but that the people, all of the people, belong to the same tribe. And therefore our government is a republic in that it expresses that kind of a level of understanding and idea. Well, the Romans, brought back by the Renaissance, et cetera, plaguing the world because this European idea of history, wake our friend here, Toshi, wake her. This idea is a nightmare, absolute nightmare, which repeats itself. It's like on automatic by now. It's a rut so deeply run, it just repeats itself automatically. There's no chance for anyone to be clever enough in terms of this rut to get out of it. Anytime you play that game, the house has stacked the deck against you. You cannot any longer do anything outside of the constrained randomness of that pattern. The term used in the 60s is co-opt. Even struggling effectively against the authoritarian situation just gives them a new alternate. They co-opt your opposition and weave it in so that they'll sell Coca-Cola with the anti-social slogan. It doesn't make any difference to them at all. Why? Because they are amoral. Because the authority is amoral. They'll be just as glad to use your criticism because it's more effective than their defense. And so they'll sell their goods with your criticism as mottos. I'm putting it bluntly so that you can see it's a very great problem. By 1969, it was apparent that was exactly what was happening. Exactly what was happening, and in fact, it did happen. Burckhardt, writing of the Renaissance. The elements needed for the restoration of a republic had been destroyed forever, and the field prepared for violence and despotism. Notice that the alternate of this is always violence and despotism. Why do you think American society in the last 20 years has become a junkyard of violence and despotism on every level? If you haven't worked for a large corporation lately, go and look and see for an hour. If you haven't been into a government agency, go and see for an hour. See for yourself. On every level, violence and despotism. Why? Because they characterize this whole co-opting of the individual by authority. It's characteristic of that ensemble of activity. But in the Renaissance, the brilliant, brutal, amoral honesty of its greatest individuals characterized for us better than any people in classical antiquity. We have Tacitus, but he doesn't say too much about specifically. But we have Machiavelli, who says nothing but specifically exactly about it. So let's go to Machiavelli just for a second here. This is the portable Machiavelli. Everything we need is in here. The Prince, chapter 25. The Prince, why does he call it not say the King? Because Augustus Caesar did not style himself a king, he styled himself Princeps, from which the word prince comes. Princeps just means first. It means before you do anything, you consult me first. Notice this is a very diplomatic way of saying, you're not doing what I'm saying because I'm king, but you're acting for your own good by consulting with me first. Notice that the idea of empire is quite different from kingdom. The idea of empire is insidious. You decide for yourself how best you can fit into what's going on. And when you've sized up what we've got and what you need to do, I'm sure you'll see it our way. That was Augustus's tactic. Hence, the prince. Chapter 25, on fortune's role in human affairs and how she can be dealt with. It is not unknown to me, writes Machiavelli, that many have held and still hold the opinion that the things of this world are in a matter controlled by fortune and by God, that men with their wisdom cannot control them, and on the contrary, that men can have no remedy whatsoever for them. And for this reason, they might judge that they need not sweat much over such matters, but let them be governed by fate. This opinion has been more strongly held in our own times because of the great variation of affairs that has been observed, and that is being observed every day, which is beyond human conjecture. Sometimes, as I think about these things, I am inclined to their opinion to a certain extent. Nevertheless, in order that our free will not be extinguished, I judge it to be true that fortune is the arbiter of only one half of our actions, and that she still leaves us the control of the other half, or almost that, to us. Notice the Machiavellian empire way of coming to terms with this. All right, destiny can control one half, but I control the other half. A little bit later on. This is not in The Prince, but in a book by Machiavelli called The Discourses. This is chapter 17, entitled, A Corrupt People Which Acquires the Freedom, Its Freedom, Can Maintain Its Freedom Only with the Greatest of Difficulty. A corrupt people which acquires its freedom can maintain its freedom only with the greatest of difficulty. Now, Machiavelli is going to not use the term here, but we need to use the term radioactive. Power is radioactive for both the authorities and the individual in this model. Now, someone who's in control has all of that radioactivity in themselves. If you depose them or kill them, that means the container for the radioactivity is gone, and now it's seeping and infecting and poisoning the whole population. And if you let it go, if you didn't have a ruler, eventually the whole people would be corrupt. So there's an imperative need to get another dictator right away to contain this poison that's corrupting the people. This is a Machiavellian way of characterizing the situation. Shake, Jerry, would you? My voice is pleasant, I know. But I hope you can hear the ideas, which are It's like the gears of the mind that have been screwing up our lives, because those gears are buzzsaw sharp. And they no longer turn other gears and make things work. They're cutting us to pieces. It's like Mario Savio said once in Berkeley in front of the administration, when the gears are grinding up people, then it's time to throw our bodies on the goddamn gears and bring them to a halt. Instead of being cut up piecemeal. It's a great insight. Here's Machiavelli from the Discourses. These were books written for, they were commissioned by Renaissance power men like Caesar Borgia and so forth, Lorenzo de' Medici. These were the books that were given to them to help them maintain control. That's what these books are about. That's what Machiavelli was all about. His idea, it's better to help men in power stay quickly and cleanly in power, that way fewer people get hurt. The sooner you realize that you're not going to change anything, the sooner you stop trying to gum up the works and by your activities destroy the lives of a lot of innocent people. It's the whole basis of mafiosa-type power, which is now characteristic of any corporation or any government in the world. This is exactly how everyone operates. This is the way. This is what Li Peng was telling the Chinese students. You're going to cause a lot of people a lot of problems. It's better for us to kill 3,000 of you now than to have to kill 300,000 next month. We're being a very good government in saying this and doing this. That's exactly what happened. Friends. Machiavelli, The Discourses, Book 1, Chapter 17. Just a few paragraphs. Machiavelli, I think that it was necessary either for the kings of Rome to be done away with or for Rome to become weak and useless in a very short period of time. For when one considers how much corruption there was in those kings, if two or three successive reigns had continued in the same way, and that corruption which was in them had spread to members of the body politic, it would no longer have been possible to reform her. But as the head was lost while the trunk was still sound, the Romans could easily bring themselves back to living an ordered and free existence. And this principle must be taken as very true, that a corrupt city which lives under a prince will never be able to regain its freedom, even if that prince and all his family are done away with. On the contrary, one prince needs to destroy the other. And without the creation of one new ruler, the city will never rest unless the goodness of a single man, together with his ability, maintains her freedom. But this freedom will last only as long as the life of that man. Now, this is poignant beyond telling. Do you know what the myth is behind this? The myth behind this is exactly the one that led Sir James George Frazer to writing The Golden Bough. The whole development of conceptual, structural anthropology developed and amplified out of this very issue, out of this myth, right here. This is the one. In Frazer, the myth is that you can't have a new ruler until the old ruler is killed. The new king to be has to kill the old king. And that's the myth. It has to run like that. The old king must die for the new king to come in. It's an authoritarian idea based on that myth that Machiavelli is talking about here. He's saying that the freedom is so precarious, so full of potential corruption, that has spread radioactively because you've deposed the bad guy. Your only hope is to have another corrupt leader come in and sop that up for himself, or to have some one good man maintain the freedom by the wholeness of his person. But in that case, you have a time limit. When that good person is gone, that's it. What's the situation? It means that the good man is the leader. He's just not exercising the corruptness. In both ways, you have the displacement of an old leader by a new leader. One new leader takes the place of the old. The other new leader refuses to take the place but does the function anyway. So that the good man is the leader outside of the government, like an Albert Schweitzer. Or they've set up in our time Jean-Paul II, the good man outside of the government. Well, we'll appeal to him, but he's not in our power structure. So President Bush says, well, Jean-Paul, please help us with the Iranians. You have a lot of credibility. Or the Dalai Lama, or somebody like that. Is the good man who maintains the freedom, but maintains it because he in a different way has authority, not within the power structure, but outside of it. Machiavelli says, but as the head was lost while the trunk was still sound, the Romans could easily bring themselves back to living an ordered and free existence in the Republic. And this principle must be taken as very true in the empire, that a corrupt city which lives under a prince will never be able to regain its freedom. Even if that prince and all his family are done away with, on the contrary, one prince needs to destroy the other, and without the creation of one new ruler, the city will never rest unless the goodness of a single man, together with his ability, maintains her freedom. But this freedom will last only as long as the life of that man. There is no better example of this than of Rome. When the Tarquins were driven out, she was immediately able to seize and maintain her liberty. But after Caesar, Gaius Caligula, and Nero were dead, the entire race of Caesar were destroyed, the city was not able to maintain her freedom or reestablish it. So they reestablished some other people as emperors. In other words, the Caesars came to an end with Nero, and then the Flavians took over, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. And after them, another group came in. Machiavelli is saying, this is the way things always are. This is the pattern. So Machiavelli is like Thucydides. He sees this is a pattern which reoccurs, and it's just different people that act out these scenarios with different ostensible plots, but it's plot number 36. It's like the Sunset Riders clique. They know that you can always sell plot number 36 in November to any audience around the world. You put it in a nice form. And plot 36 sells. Machiavelli sees that this is a pattern, and the pattern is there because the psychic energy is not integrated. And when it's not integrated, it has a wild, destructive quality to it. There's a violent quality which requires a surrogate balance instead of the balance that the deep self has. It requires a balance of some strong man to handle that power. Look at all this power. We got to have somebody control this. We got to have some group control this. And so the more power that's generated, the stronger the control of a group that's necessary. The best case in recent history is the Third Reich. generating all of that power and then needing to have a real strong man, superhuman man, to contain it. What are we going to do with all that? Oh. So the problem is an archetypal problem. Notice what it is archetypal of is the way in which history happens for human beings. That's why we're discussing all of this in the history section. If you do not develop your deep self, if your soul is not actually present, then this scenario plays itself out to the bitter end. Notice that by now the situation, even in Roman times, the situation was, even if there is a good man, some single good man who can control that whole energeia, that whole dynamis, outside of the power system, it's only as good as long as his life continues. So the problem of maintaining the control beyond his life becomes one of finding some way to transcendentally or mythically continue his life. Otherwise, there's no chance whatsoever. Are you hearing this? The situation, though, is that in actual fact, the only real workable fulcrum is for individual human beings themselves to develop their souls, to develop their deep selves. That is the only real workable action. And it's only when there is a population of spiritually healthy human beings that this nightmare of violence by authority and tyranny is brought to an end. That is the only real condition anywhere in the universe, on any star system, with any kind of sentient beings. This pattern plays itself out, you would be surprised. So that the spiritual health of the people is the only way to go, is the only effective way to go. Once that's seen, though it's a bitter realization how far we are from that, once that's seen, at least there's like the bodhisattva ebullience that at least we know that this is the real journey. God help us, it's so long, but it's the only real journey that there is. So that development of that working compassion to help others be themselves is actually the only viable position that there is, other than this nightmare. Other than this nightmare, there is absolutely nothing else. Come in, Tony. Come in. We'll just be a minute. So we've looked at Collingwood's The Idea of History. We've looked at Tacitus, the Annals of Imperial Rome and the Agricola. We've looked at Machiavelli, the Prince and the Discourses. We've looked at Burckhardt, the Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. And we've looked at them in terms of Thucydides and Benjamin Franklin. Now you can see that in all of this, we're operating at a very high level, very sophisticated level. But the synthesizing core is not some kind of academic idea, but a realization of our capacities as human beings. We're the only real trigger in the whole works. none of this can come together any other place other than in our experience. So that individually and collectively, we are the only moving part in the whole picture. No matter how grand all of this image base is, and I must tell you, I could extend it 20 times, the only moving part is our life. Our life is the only moving part in this whole scenario. If we don't do it, it doesn't happen. Now notice that the ultimate cop-out there is to think that in some great overall authoritarian plan, all this is provided for. That is an amplified projection of the empire perspective. It cannot possibly be true in terms of the relentless logic of inquiry. What in fact is true is that we must take responsibility in our lives and do it, do our part as much as we can do. We don't have to do it all, but we sure have to do our part. That is that's the bottom line that comes out of this. For instance, it's the bottom line in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. He's constantly saying by implication, it's really not only worth it to take stock and thus active conscious control of your life, it's the only real thing that you can do. But it's enough. That is enough. That's the door that opens then into the realm of the real. And you can't ahead of time tell what's going to come out of that. Magical things come out of that. But the door to the real is that the individual takes conscious integration of their pattern and thus comes into resonance with the real patterns that are operating out here. Not the empire slogan patterns, but the real patterns that are happening despite the empires, despite the authoritarian structures. What's real is actually occurring. The rest of it is on level of dream, actual dream. Someone asked a Lama one time, said, what does all this worldly power look like? He said, it looks like thunderstorms in the ether to the wisdom eye, just local thunderstorms. That's about it. But if you think that your whole horizon of possibility is just in one section where the thunderstorm is going on, you never know. And that's why the hermetic helper is always reaching the hand down saying, come on up out of that goddamn hole. You don't have to live there. Come out of that hole and into the sunlight and take a look around. Yeah, it is a storm right there. But that storm is a tempest in a teapot. The real exceeds it by infinite qualities. And you belong there. Your life belongs in the real, not in that nightmare. No matter how scared you are, come out of there. Don't stay in there. So that's what we're doing. Thank you.